The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
I'm surprised. I'm surprised that you don't have Warren, Krugman, Ocasio-Cortez, Sanders, the whole lot. Why aren't they up in arms? If they want to defend the poor, why aren't they talking about the fact that inflation is not a progressive tax, it's a regressive tax. It hurts those at the bottom end of the spectrum worst. It reinforces the trends of wealth disparity by further impoverishing the poor.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You know, it's funny, Dave, I've gotten to where I don't watch much TV, but when I do, my blood pressure goes way down when I can turn an old Western on. And the other night I was watching a Jimmy Stewart Western called Bend of the River. I won't go into the whole story, but it shows how quickly a town can change when there's a gold rush. And it makes me think of what's going on right now. When there's a gold rushes come after the secret's out. Gold is found, and usually people try to keep a secret. When the secret's out, everything changes. Now, we have a gold rush going on right now, but it's still sort of veiled. It's in secret, and the people who are collecting the gold don't really want us to know.
It's interesting. Nixon closed the gold window in 1971. We had deficits, which were ballooning. We had an economy which was shifting towards recession. 73, 74 ended up being nasty in that regards. It was not surprising to see the world central banks scrambling to diversify out of dollars and into gold.
Well, and during that time, France wanted to try to be secret about it, even though they were taking just about all of it.
And frankly, that was in the mid to late 60s, where they were taking a lot of gold. And of course, we know it got to the critical point in 71. Gold represented in that era the legitimate asset behind the U.S. dollar. And as the fiscal position of the United States was being compromised, the world rightly assessed that there was a greater risk in the relationship between the dollar and gold, and that relationship being disconnected. And it was a debt problem that became a currency problem.
Isn't that how it always happens? It's a debt problem that turns into some form of crisis. Yet at this point, there seems to be a similar type of activity by the people in the know.
It may be happening all over again. So, you know, you recall that 70s show? Well, we may have that in 2019. You got central banks which bought the most gold in a single year, last year, 2018, at 651.5 tons. That was a 74% increase year over year. And that is the most gold bought by central banks in any year since the 1971 central bank gold rush.
Isn't it interesting that the central banks have purchased more gold in a single year since 1971, and yet the American buyer of gold is at almost an all-time low? You know, the U.S. Mint said that gold sales last year were the lowest in over a decade.
Yeah, go back to the 70s. By the time the public fully understood that the U.S. Bretton Woods currency debacle was on them, the gold price had already moved 500%. And that was not the last leg. The last leg was an additional 400% on top of that. That was what was still to come. And what is this? This was all reflecting a diminishment in purchasing power. It was also representing a loss of confidence in the monetary authorities, specifically the U.S. Central Bank at the time.
Well, isn't it interesting? As we speak, you've got people still investing in these index funds, just thinking that the central banks have got their back. Look at how much money and how much stimulus from the Federal Reserve it's taken just to get us to the point we're at.
And so here we are sitting at less than 10% from all-time peak prices in the stock market. You've got fiscal deficits, which are widening. You've got global economic growth slowing. If you look at what the Fed has done, they've put rates at about 2.25%. And frankly, to the peer group that you're comparing them to, that's rather high, but it's only half of what they were prior to the global financial crisis. So we cut rates from 5.25 down to just 25 basis points. And even that extreme 500 basis point cut was not enough to avoid the recession of 2007 and 2008. I don't know, but it appears that 200 basis points to give, if we were to go back to that quarter point, is that going to get it done the next time the Fed actively intervenes?
Yeah, not when it took what it did in the past. Now, what's interesting is the very people who cut all those interest rates and are telling the stock market that they've got their back, and Powell, you know, basically saying things are fine, pay no attention to my latest action. These are the same entities, these central banks, that have a 74% year-on-year increase in their gold buying. They know something that they're not saying, Dave.
Well, so look at the lack of ammunition on the part of the Fed. And I think in answer to our earlier question, no, 200 basis points is not enough. And what that really suggests is that the unconventional toolbox is closer to being opened and used again than you might think. And I think, frankly, if you're watching the actions of central bankers, this is what you may imply. Central banks are aggressively diversifying into gold, which is a very different signal being sent by their actions than by most of what the central bank community's words or the reassurances that they continually give to the marketplace. It's high praise that you hear for the current state of the global economy, and yet they're piling gold like it was 1971.
Being an American in the United States and being denominated in dollars, I think sometimes we're a little bit like that kid that's walking down the street with the earbuds on. He's not hearing anything that's going on the outside. Look at what gold's been doing against foreign currencies, the people who don't have their dollar earbuds in. It's amazing.
Yeah, priced in foreign currencies, gold is trading at or near all-time highs. So yeah. You may not see, as an American or someone who prices their assets in dollars, what the rest of the world already sees. And that is a likely problem if you continue to ignore it. But I also think it's an opportunity if you're willing to act upon it. I think since stocks began to sell off in October, look at the exchange traded fund. GLD has added 93 tons. It's at a new total of 823 tons in that product. This is a healthy indicator of investor demand. This is traffic that's beginning to increase. Sentiment is shifting to more positive in that investor category. We talked about the central bank community. That's a separate purchase category. The investor category is very intriguing. January saw inflows into GLD at 36 tons compared to January of 2018, which was just 4 tons. And then, you know, in the last 6 months, we've had everyone from Ray Dalio, manager of the largest hedge fund in the world, Jeff Gundlach, who's the new bond king. As many of you may know, Bill Gross retired this week. Mark Mobius, the real estate legend Sam Zell. All of them have disclosed gold purchases and have been suggesting that the world already knows, and they do too, both if you look in retrospect, but also if you're looking forward in time, that you better save in a reliable unit of account. That when financial markets are dislocating, gold is a safe haven. And that when governments get desperate, you want a part of your wealth positioned outside the traditional banking system so that you can avoid repression. We're talking about financial repression. Negative interest rates, hidden inflation taxes, those are kind of the quiet enemies of today's saver. But with real ultimate deleterious effect to someone's assets.
Well, I remember talking to Jim Deeds. You know, we have Jim on a regular basis on the show, and Jim was in the investment world back in the late 60s, and that was when gold was illegal to own. But he started seeing, a little bit like these other investors, you're talking about Dalio and Gundlach and Mobius, he read a book back in the late 60s that told him the problem, and he started to see what the central banks in Europe were doing. They were accumulating massive amounts of gold. It's this gold rush you're talking about that seems to be starting again. Jim started buying silver, and when you have that type of nose for what's going on, you can be ahead of the crowd.
To me, what we built into the vaulted program, giving investors the opportunity to own a liquid, accessible, transparent position in kilo bars with the Royal Canadian Mint, that what we're talking about is creating an alternative for the trapped U.S. investor who may say to themselves, look, I've always been at Bank of America. I've always been at Wells Fargo. I've always been at pick your bank, ABC.
Right.
But this is a substitute for banking and savings deposits, and I think it'll serve investors very well in the pressured years ahead. If you haven't considered it, look at it. Vaulted.com is, to me, the best alternative you can find for a cash position where you need liquidity, you need transparency, you need accessibility. It has all those things.
Sometimes I think it's just habit that makes us keep things in a bank account, not necessarily looking at the interest or the negative side. We're doing a little bit of home improvement right now in the kitchen. And my wife said, why don't I just go ahead and pull the money out for the next few things and we'll put it in cash in an envelope and we'll just pay it out. And the first thing I said was, no, let's go ahead and leave it in the account until we need it. And then I caught myself. Why? Why? They're not paying me any interest. You know what it is? It's habit. So if we change our habits, like with Vaulted, you don't have to keep it in an account that you're not earning any interest if you want to put yourself on a personal gold standard.
It was interesting. I read an article by Bill Bonner recently, and his idea was that we do what we do because we're used to it.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes how we get into trouble, is we never rethink why we do what we do or how we do it. And I think only when circumstances get to an extreme, or the pain threshold gets to a point where we are forced to reconsider, do we then look at our activities and our habits and perhaps reassess and reorganize them.
Well, do you think possibly some of the tensions internationally that are breaking globalization down are also moving the central banks into gold?
I mean, I think both central banks and just the international investor demand for it. So internationally, there is a breakdown of globalization, and you've got the requirement in that context for local governments to become more sensitive to populist outcries of discontent. And, you know, there are reasonable reasons to look at long-term growth prospects diminishing. And again, politics begins to transform. I think the rest of the world knows only too well how governments sometimes deal with their own fiscal issues, and the inflation tax is something that's used on a routine basis all over the world. It is a part of the government toolkit to redistribute assets, to choose winners and losers when they themselves are under duress.
It's funny that our Federal Reserve almost treats inflation as our friend at this point. We've got this targeted inflation. Yet inflation, if you really look at Germany back in the 1920s, Venezuela today, inflation always ends in starvation.
Yeah, I mean, certainly at the extremes it does, and getting there, the anticipation of it, is something that wreaks havoc on virtually every asset class. So I think as a complement to, as a precursor to more global political tensions, we are seeing foreign governments aggressively accumulate gold. We mentioned last year's record-breaking 651 tons, and according to Meridian Macro, the Swiss Federal Customs Administration shows gold exports to China coming in at about 450 tons a year. So the Bank of China doesn't disclose these numbers, and they don't adjust their official holding figures to reflect these imports. And those numbers are also not included in the 651 tons accumulated last year by central banks. So again, keep in mind that we could actually see closer to 1,000 tons of central bank demand if you're talking about the PBOC as well. Some percentage of those ounces of the 450 tons going into China, obviously, are to meet local on-the-street demand as well.
So if we've been listening to central banks, everything they're saying about what they're going to do next for the market, we should also look at what they're doing themselves. I mean, what is this saying?
I think in short, we're on the cusp of a major event in the gold market. If you look at 1365, the gold price, that was the level that gold peaked at in 2016. And it represents the last meaningful resistance, in my view, in a move back to the previous highs of 1900. There's stopping points along the way, but 1365 is a significant level. I think the lows were established in the gold price December 2015. And the U.S. market has largely ignored this recovery story, with the general equities indexes capturing most of your investor enthusiasm, capturing most of the public's attention.
Passive investing is what you're addressing.
Yeah, well, now we have the next leg higher opening in the gold market. And frankly, what the catalyst is hardly matters. But what we do know is that the context is set. The context is set, and that should be obvious. But I guess in case it's not obvious, if this is a new story to you, I think it's worth looking at some of the micro as well as some of the macro in terms of the analysis. We had a notable profit warning from Dow and DuPont expecting a decline in profits. And interesting in the notes on their announcement, Dow DuPont is a very significant chemical player, right? So they're pointing to Chinese and European economic slowdown as one of the contributing factors to their profit warning. And it's not the profit warning of that company that bothers me. It's the cause. Step back, and I think it's worth highlighting the importance of Chinese slowing growth,
which has been the engine of the growth. It's allowed our Federal Reserve to do what it's done over the last 10 years because China's continued to grow.
So the trade conflict, frankly, has not been the feature in sort of this earnings season's disappointments. The Financial Times says that here in the first quarter, earnings tipped for the first decline in 3 years. Analysts slashed their year-on-year forecasts as companies succumbed to pressure on margins. That's from today's Financial Times. And, you know, as we noticed in previous commentaries, China has driven global GDP growth for quite a few years. Mm-hmm. As their economy slows, and frankly, it's probably just a fraction of the official number. They say that 2019's numbers are going to be 6.4% growth. We're probably going to be a fraction of that. And the impact is already showing up in the earnings and the profit disappointments across a very diverse group of companies, whether it's the chemical giants, the chip makers, phone manufacturers, auto parts suppliers. It is being revealed.
Well, and you know that the growth is being overstated because you have a contact in China that told you so, but we can't really name him and we can't talk to him because he's, you know, fearing for his life if he actually gives true economic statistics.
It's true at this point that any line into and out of China is a recorded line. Mm. There is no such thing as private communications in that country at this point. China's manufacturing index fell again, in January. It's now at a three-year low. And it suggests a very difficult operating environment in China for manufacturing. The Eurozone as well, their PMI, Purchasing Managers Index, according to Reuters, fell for a six-month in a row. And they're now at a five-and-a-half-year low.
Car sales in China, they've been plummeting. I saw a chart yesterday. It's just, it's not minor. It's a major difference in car buying.
From the first of the year, the decline was fairly insignificant. But as we move towards December, it began to open up to where, you know, again, December was a horrific month and it just added to what ended up being a pretty nasty year overall. Car sales declined in China last year. This is 2018 for the first time in 30 years. For the first time in 30 years. So, I mean, again, there are some trends that are being broken and some things that I think investors should pay attention to, which are, again, backdrop issues if you want to understand the context for why central banks are interested in greater monetary stability and creating some offsets within their own balance sheets and why investors are doing the same.
Well, we have to watch two things. I mean, people have to have cars. People have to have smartphones almost these days. And, you know, it seems that both are dropping in China.
The modern world, what would we be without a smartphone?
True.
Chinese smartphones, yeah, their shipments fell by 14% year over year. You had imports into China. Total imports, which fell by 7.6%, exports from the country for the full year down by 4.4%. And whether it's executives at Intel or at NVIDIA, they are all pointing out on their earnings calls that there's a weakening in consumer demand and it's driving revenue expectations lower. And this is a growing business executive concern. Again, we're back to one thing. The macroeconomic conditions are souring, and in particular, China is impacting the bottom line for a lot of multinationals.
Well, last week or a couple of weeks ago, actually, you brought up that Germany was slowing. So the European region, because Germany, we talked about being an engine of growth for Europe, the whole European region is also slowing.
Right. So that was German manufacturing we talked about a few weeks ago, and Europe does continue to slow. Italy had its GDP figures contract in the fourth quarter, so it draws its economy into recession. Italy is officially in recession. As you can imagine, when you've got a declining economic base and economic activity, it makes it more difficult to service your debt. So think about the Target 2 obligations. You have big shifts in these cross-border liabilities that are sort of held with or held through or at least marked by the ECB. The big shifts in terms of their liability accumulation occurred in Italy. If you go back to 2011, that was the first major increase. And then it's gotten progressively worse with those numbers accelerating to the downside, 2014 to 2016. But I mean, think about this. Prior to the 2009 global financial crisis, the Italians were a net creditor according to their Target 2 balances. 10 years later, it's a half a trillion, 482, close to half a trillion dollars of cross-border obligations. That's a real issue. Mm-hmm. So again, slowing economic activity, increasing debt payments, that's a nasty cocktail.
We talked in October on the commentary that Draghi was just first talking about tightening up a little bit in Europe. That didn't last long, did it?
Right. Looking at ECB policy, you can see why they're hesitant to tighten financial conditions in earnest, because you do have issues within Germany, issues within Italy. The issues within France, I think at this point, are largely political, but I think we'll see more indications of economic weakness in France as well. Draghi is now in his final year at the ECB, and in recent weeks, they suspended the asset purchase plan But I think they're going to have to reconsider that as an option. Again, if they continue to see Eurozone growth slowing and that being a spreading theme, it was only a few weeks ago that they stopped that.
Yeah. So the asset purchase plan, for those listeners who don't know what that is, that's when the central bank comes in and buys everything. Okay. And what he was talking about is, we're not going to do that anymore. And remember when we talked about this, we said, well, there goes Europe.
Right. So they were slowing considerably in October, and then by the end of the year came to an abrupt halt. So we don't know the precise threshold, but when the market swoons, rates will go lower here in the U.S. If the balance sheet normalization, which has been a promise, and Powell, that was his initiative straight out of the gates, and we shrunk our balance sheet by a mere 10%. And now, if you're listening to the dovish language from the Fed, that's been suspended already. So again, we're weeks into tightening at the ECB. We're weeks into the balance sheet normalization at the Fed. And what have we got here? Already an about face, because we have considerable weakness. And you know, yes, as soon as they start recanting, as soon as they bring out the dovish language, you have a massive rally in the Dow and the S&P and the NASDAQ. I think we need to look at that backdrop again: slowing economic activity, increasing debt burdens, rising interest rates. This is, as I said before, this is a very nasty cocktail.
What a difference a quarter makes. If we were to go back, let's just go back before the last quarter of 2018. The stock market was hitting all-time highs. The economy was supposedly flying. We had virtually no volatility in the market. We had the Federal Reserve saying that they were going to have 4 interest rate increases in 2019 and that they were going to reduce the $4 trillion that they have on their balance sheet. What a difference a quarter makes.
That's right, because in just that one quarter with a little bit of stock market volatility, we have a complete about face. And the central bank presidents are reversing course. The markets are, once again, conditioned to believe that central banks will support their leverage, will support their speculation when push comes to shove. And now the markets expect, in fact, if you're looking at the odds of an increase or decrease in interest rates, I think it's somewhere between 28% odds that we have a decrease in interest rates here in the United States by year end, and a 0% chance of an increase, whereas 2 increases in 2019, again, that was the language used as recently as early in the fourth quarter. 2 increases with a baseline assumption, that's gone. But again, the swoon in the stock market in Q4, do you remember? Powell was concerned about bubble dynamics in the stock market as we headed into October.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Then we get volatility, and here we are only 8.5% below all-time market highs, and he's pandering to the market.
And Trump, remember, Trump was concerned with bubble dynamics, too, until he got elected. And then he loved the bubble.
He loved the bubble. This is his bubble, and he don't want to see it burst.
Yeah.
Well, the Wall Street Journal editorial board, I think, was spot on. This is last October. This is what they had to say about sort of, before you are running your victory laps in the central bank community, consider this. Now, I'm going to quote from Wall Street Journal. I think it was October 10th. 10 years after the financial panic, the architects of the rescue policies are taking a victory lap. The final payments on any Fed monetary cycle aren't merely the results when interest rates are low and policy is easy. The verdict is clear only at the end of the cycle, when the Fed has to unwind its accommodation and interest rates rise. Only then can the world see clearly whether the Fed overdid the stimulus with nasty consequences on the other end. So I mean, that's where we're at. You begin to see in quarter four, the fourth quarter of 2018, that no, actually, this isn't really a success story. If they have to normalize, if they pull back, as they take away the proverbial punch bowl, guess what happens? Everyone is unhappy.
Makes me wonder if the loneliest guy in the room is the guy with the QT t-shirt. Nobody loves him. Nobody even let him go. You know, we had QE, which is quantitative easing, and that guy gets all the credit, and that guy actually gets all the action because they introduced QT. He turned out to be a shy, lonely man, and now QT is being dismissed.
Right. So the experiment with QT, very short-lived exercise. The Fed observes normalization is, in fact, an impossibility. It's an impossibility in a world where asset price inflation and where economic stability have been propped up with unconventional monetary policy measures, right? So that's the issue. Getting back to normal would be like the addict getting back to a natural state without the externally induced euphoria from a drug. What is life like when you have to go back to boring? Well, without the drug.
And how often have you asked the question, all right, if the market goes up with QE, does it go down with QT?
That was our mantra all year long last year as we headed towards the fourth quarter and said, look, if it benefits on the upside, there's going to be a cost on the downside. Withdrawals are difficult, sometimes even deadly. I mean, whether you're a drug addict or if you're dealing with QT and QE.
So what you're saying is no. In this leveraged economy, you have to have QE to continue to rise.
The bottom line is that the overleveraged world we live in, it cannot handle tighter financial conditions without a considerable adjustment to asset prices. And that's where it becomes politically controversial. Who wants their home price to go down? Who wants their 401k to diminish? Who wants their pension to be even more underfunded than it already is? So our conversation last week, I think, is particularly important because we begin to see what happens. Political pressure builds by constituency groups when those constituency groups are under pressure or are in a lost position, and they start crying for blood.
You have the haves and you have the have-nots, and you want to make sure that you're voting on the haves side, or, you know, the designated winner.
You lower values in fixed income, you lower values in stocks, you lower values in real estate, and that raises the political stakes. And I think that's where we're at. The bottom line is that they can't normalize in an overleveraged world. So we go back to last week's conversation. We ask the question, who's the designated winner?
Right.
Who's the designated loser? If credit flows are two politically selected winners, then again, this is, in my view, a problem with the nature of democracy. Mm-hmm. It's the best form amongst the worst forms, right? I think that's been said better than I just said it, but maybe it was de Tocqueville. It's the worst form of government except for all the rest,
right?
Is, I think, exactly what he said. So the nature of democracy is to direct capital and credit to those constituency groups that put you or keep you in power. And the losers are typically the ones who end up being in the minority of votes. Mm-hmm. And I think this is very interesting. The last 2 weeks, we've brought out a new sort of redistributive competition.
It feels like socialism is knocking at the door.
Well, the Democrats don't have any other hook to hang their hats on. For years, they appealed to populace, and yet Trump stole their vote. He stole the populist vote. So the only direction they could go is hard left. And so you've got Warren, you've got Krugman, his voice piece through the New York Times, you've got Ocasio-Cortez, you've got Sanders, you've got this march back to the already tried, the already failed 90% tax rate. And that is what is on the minds, that is what is in the hearts, that is what is now in a variety of legislative proposals, somewhere between the current number and 90 at the far edge. You've got Omar from Minneapolis, who hit the 90% number. Why? Let's fund the Green New Deal. Mm. We talked about the Green New Deal. I kind of tongue-in-cheek a few weeks ago said, is that a different version of what we knew as the Red New Deal? That's on the income side. You've got Warren, who's proposing a 2% annual wealth tax, right? Sanders, he likes the estate tax at 77%. So again, if you can line up 51% of the public to say it's a good idea for us to take from him to give to him or her, again, redistribute from the haves to the have-nots.
Does Warren know? Okay, you're talking about a 2% annual wealth tax. Does Warren know that the Federal Reserve beat her to the punch?
I think that's hilarious. I think it's hilarious that legislators are capturing the headlines with these proposals of massive increases in taxation. When the monetary policy crew, the folks at the Fed, they've already decreed a 2% tax. That's what we know is the targeted inflation rate. We're not represented, of course. You remember the whole
cry. I don't remember voting for him, yeah.
No taxation without representation?
Yeah.
No. These are not elected officials. Nonetheless, we have the 2% wealth tax already via the inflation target. That's already a reality. Granted, it doesn't apply to all wealth. It's just to bank deposits. It's just to your liquid assets. But you might argue, if you're one of those that questions the veracity of the inflation number, right? We're talking about the 2% number.
right. I'm sure that's real.
Then actually the inflation tax is quite a bit higher than that. Could be 2, could be 3 or 4. My dad and I were talking about this last week. He said, Dave, what do you think the real world inflation number is? I said, it's probably closer to 5. He said, I think it's probably 8. And I mean, again, this is debatable depending on how you calculate the number and what you leave out of the number or include in the number. You can get to any number. The reality is this. The inflation number has never mattered. It never will matter. It's when you tip over from the consumer's experience of the world of buying stuff and they begin to anticipate higher levels. Anticipation of inflation is what redefines asset classes. Anticipation of inflation is what redefines the way people invest their dollars. And I think it's only fair to point out that inflation and this tax hurts those on the lowest economic rung the very worst.
Right.
So I'm surprised. I'm surprised that you don't have Warren, Krugman, Ocasio-Cortez, Sanders, the whole lot. Why aren't they up in arms? If they want to defend the poor, why aren't they talking about the fact that inflation is not a progressive tax. It's a regressive tax. It hurts those at the bottom end of the spectrum worst. It reinforces the trends of wealth disparity by further impoverishing the poor. And it only hits the wealthy minimally.
And you talked about it being a tax and taxation without representation. It makes me wonder if the Federal Reserve actually has a T that we could throw into the water, because that was what happened in Boston.
We're not being represented. Right. And I think one of the features of Calamiris's book that I appreciated most was how since the 16th century, inflation is not an accident. Inflation shows up over and over again as a choice, and it is a choice by those in power to participate in the redistribution of assets.
It's a friend of the governments, and it's an enemy of the people.
Not an accident. It has been, it always will be a way of taxing the savings and deposit base of a society. And what we see growing as a far-left consensus is that whatever the tax number is, the all-in number, inclusive of the inflation target, inclusive of the explicit wealth tax, which Warren is talking about, along with your traditional income taxes, capital gains, inheritance taxes, it's never enough.
Right, right.
It won't be enough until the playing field is leveled. And I need to remind you that this is not exactly compatible with free markets. This is not exactly compatible with capitalism and this hard swing to the redistributive left. It may, in fact, be why Howard Schultz, you know, the Starbucks CEO, he chose to run for president. He's going to run against Trump. And he's not doing it as a Democrat, even though he has a lifelong affiliation with the Democratic Party. He announced his candidacy as an independent. And I think it's because you've got this radicalization of the party. It's been a theme, certainly in high relief for the last few months, but they don't really have an alternative. If they don't swing hard left, they don't have a clear differentiator between what Trump is doing, which in some senses is socially progressive, in some senses taking care of labor, in some sense taking care of the populist voice. I mean, he's tough to nail down. And by the way, the GOP hates him. Right? Because he doesn't align enough with the standard party GOP line. So the GOP insiders hate Trump, but he's captured the platform. He's also captured the populist platform from the Democrats. So you have this greater radicalization of the Democrats and the GOP.
Well, and populism, it's interesting. You know, people loved populism when it got Trump in. There were people who loved populism. But populism can go many directions, can it not?
It has many faces. And again, so consistent with Calamiris and Haber's historical analysis, we got the swing towards populism. And there's a greater demand for redistribution. This is normal. In the context of financial market turbulence and with expectations of hard times ahead and of those sort of in the middle who've been lost, right? So why is the populist voice so loud at present globally? Well, the rich have gotten richer. There's no doubt that asset price inflation has benefited the balance sheets of the not 1%, but the 1/1%. And, you know, again, we've got this new competitive political sport. Who can take the most from that fraction of 1% and hand it out in the largest numbers possible?
It reminds me of the Peter Paul quote that you had.
Well,
you know, if you're robbing from Peter to pay Paul, Paul's going to like you a little bit more.
That's right. You get a great supporter in Paul if you're taking from Peter to redistribute to Paul. The wealthy didn't get the signal in 2008. If they did not get the signal in 2008, if they were in Europe and they didn't get the signal in 2011, I think they should be acting now because Madame Guillotine is being dusted off. You've got the sharp edge of redistribution. It is being honed as we speak. My opinion, take it for what it's worth. Wealth needs to be a lot less obvious in the years ahead. I think being not in the fraction of 1%, but even in the 1%, which means you're making maybe $100,000 a year, being in the 1% means that the 99% have you outvoted. They have a far louder representative voice. And as long as votes count, 51% is sufficient to become tyranny and to guarantee redistribution.
Well, like we started the show, there is a gold rush going on with the central banks, not with the people yet, but with the central banks. And so you said wealth needs to be a lot less obvious in the years ahead.
And frankly, I think if you can take it off balance sheet, gold's not a bad way to do that. So, back to inflation for a moment. I read an interesting book on Sunday discussing the FIRE movement. FIRE is an acronym that stands for Financial Independence Retiring Early. And this is it's a growing movement among millennials who are kind of dealing with this angst and malaise of lower job opportunities, high student debt, and just kind of looking at the world and saying, do I really want to work until I'm 65 to then enjoy the good life? Or is there some way to sort of hack this and get a better outcome faster? Those that have chosen to scale down lifestyle expenses and scale up their savings, and their target is generally between 50 and 70% of income for savings, so that within a decade, they can achieve financial independence and even consider that early retirement. And again, early retirement, not by a few years, but like in your 30s, in your 40s.
Well, and that reminds me of a conversation you told me years ago that you had with John Templeton.
Yeah, the 50% idea was a compelling one. I adopted it after meeting and listening to John Templeton back in 2004. And I kept on thinking that, this idea of saving 50%, that's what his argument was. He said, look, if the Chinese save 50%, you should save
51%.
Hmm. And I mean, obviously it's an arbitrary number, but the point is wealth is accumulated only if saved. It's not on the basis of speculation. You can go out and play the lottery every day for the rest of your life and prove the poorhouse right. That's not the recipe for success. Saving and living beneath your means is. But I was reading through this book, and there's some basic assumptions that I think the whole group and the whole movement are missing. I kept on thinking that the weaknesses that need to be wrestled with within this FIRE, quote-unquote, community, they tie to assumptions about asset price stability and growth. Mm-hmm. So again, index investing is very popular because it's cheap. And cheap ends up defining everything. Well, I can tell you, there is a way to be penny wise and pound foolish, and that would be by buying and holding index funds and just forgetting about them. The other thing I think is really important, and many investors lose sight of this, including this group of well-intentioned and I think well-organized people within the FIRE community, is this issue of the quiet and the often neglected nasty inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Pennywise in the way of life, that's not inherently problematic. But inadequately protecting against inflation, I think, is where the community may experience the pound foolish part of the adage. Buying gold is never cheap. It never has been. You have to store it. You have to transport it. This was why the central banks wanted to move against it. 1922, the Conference of Genoa, central bankers gathered from around the world, and they said, it's just too much hassle. Do you know the security involved to move a real asset like that? Why don't we just exchange paper receipts? Why don't we exchange paper receipts instead of actually moving physical gold? That was the first decline, if you will, in the gold standard, was when we moved to the quote-unquote gold exchange standard. The point being, there is high cost to the metal, and it's one of the reasons why I think the community neglects it. At the same time, they don't think about inflation. Their love affair with index investing, that has to be addressed, but this regressive inflation tax also has to be addressed. And we're talking about a generation which has seen inflation diminish to almost nothing.
This is a generation that doesn't remember the 70s because they weren't born. They haven't had inflation in their lifetime. The other thing, too, is they really were in college when we had our last global financial crisis, or maybe in high school. And so try to hand this type of person a book, and it's almost like it's a bother, or pay them back in cash. It's almost like it's a bother. And so we do live in an age where they don't want to deal with having to make investment decisions. They just want stability. I understand that. Wouldn't it be nice if you could just put money into an indexed fund or a passive investment and know that you can count on the growth that we've had over the last 10 years?
If anybody wants financial stability in the years and decades ahead, they have to pay attention to what inflation does. Because inflation, not only the stated rate, but the real world rate, is something that even if you have a positive rate of return of 3 or 5 or 7 or 10%, that inflation factor may take you in real terms negative.
Right.
right? So it's the silent thief that you may feel like doing a victory lap because look at what I got, my 10%. Well, how much of that did you actually get to keep? And remember the real equation, which subtracts out inflation and taxes, and it's really what you get to keep at the end of the day after those two factors.
It's like having a water bucket with a hole in it. And you get down to the river, you've got a lot of water. By the time you get back to the house, it's gone.
It's not a big hole if you're talking about the euro inflation. Euro area inflation rate sits at an average right now, if you're averaging all the countries, at 1.4%. Now, look, if interest rates over there are still negative, in negative territory, then you're obviously talking about still deeply negative interest rates in real terms. The U.S., if you're talking about our interest rate and inflation rate, the U.S. sits after tax and inflation right near zero. So as in the 1970s, when fiscal largesse and debt accumulated too quickly, inflation became the most politically viable solution. And that is becoming the most likely scenario, not only here in the U.S., but globally.
Okay, but I can tell you, in the decades that I've been alive, I've watched our government not really have to pay back their debt. And at this point, we're increasing our debt at about the most rapid pace I think that we've ever increased it.
This is a confidence game, and we'll continue to throttle this as long as we can. We'll continue to kick the can as long as we can. And that game of kicking the can down the road is still alive. We're enabled to do that via the credit markets, and it's working around the world. Mm-hmm. The issue, and this is an issue that our guest last week highlighted, is that debt levels are reaching critical thresholds that can challenge the system's ability to efficiently chug along. You can't expect economic growth when you've got too much debt, and to service that debt is costing the system so much. So last year, we added $1.36 trillion in debt. That's here in the United States, $1.36 trillion. That's 1 year's deficit. That brings us to a total of $21.97 trillion. Now, if you go back to the pre-crisis number, we had $9 trillion in total debt. Use your $9 trillion number as a base year, just so you can compare the aggressive growth in debt that we're seeing on a year-by-year basis. You know, if you compare $1 trillion to 22, it doesn't seem like much. But when you compare 1.36 to $9 trillion, which is the number that we had prior to the crisis, we're increasing the national debt at a 15% annual rate.
Okay, let's put that in a household sense. Let's say, Dave, over the last 4 or 5 years, you've been running your household and going 15% a year further into debt. Doesn't that imply that we're broke?
That's exactly what it implies. It implies that the U.S. Treasury is empty. It implies the government is broke. Now you'd say, wait. No, that's not true. We have not only the cash flow from taxes, but we can always increase taxes. So how can you be broke when you've got the far left who are going to increase taxes and take care of this fiscal mess? Well, I'm just telling you, the treasury is empty. And if you're talking about what we need to finance operations and meet outstanding obligations, what was required last year was an increase of national debt well above $1 trillion just for 2018. And I don't think the prospects for 2019 are much better. So does that compute? We had an operational deficiency of $1.37 trillion.
You just had a meeting with your dad. Okay. And I'm glad you guys get together. That's awesome. It's been 6 months, I think, since you saw him last. As you discussed the business, if we were going into the red at that rate, would you guys keep the office open? I mean, is there any reason to have a business open if you're going into the red 15% more a year?
Well, I think one of the things that you ask as a business is how much liquidity do we have to suffer through a period where business may be slow.
Right.
And so that's a question of reserves.
You want to have some reserves.
You want to have reserves. We're not talking about treasury reserves. We're talking about the treasury being empty. Yes. We're talking about, instead of liquidity, we're talking about credit lines. So really, a company or a country under duress has to ask the question, how much credit do we have? We take for granted that we have unlimited credit because we have the world's reserve currency and because we've had a number of arrangements, whether it was the petrodollar arrangement or the, you know, sort of mercantilist recycling of dollars and Chinese goods, which we've had over the last 20, 30 years. In both cases, we've had an audience to purchase, the Japanese, the Chinese, our friends in the Middle East. We've never had to ask the question in the post-Bretton Woods era, from whence will the credit flow?
Okay, but you said post-Bretton Woods era. Okay, and Bretton Woods really, for all intents, ended in 1971, August 15th, 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window. If we were sitting here in 1969, okay, let's just go back 50 years. If we were sitting here in 1969 and knew what we knew was going to happen in 1971, we'd be buying gold, Dave.
This is Jacques Rouff. You know, de Gaulle would not listen to him. Literally, de Gaulle will not meet with him.
Hmm.
So he goes to Le Monde and he starts writing opinion letters on what the French authorities should be doing. And after writing two or three and getting published in the Paris paper, the big Paris paper, because now all of a sudden people are paying attention to Jacques Rouff's opinion. Now all of a sudden the politicians pay attention. And what do? In the late 60s, they start taking the gold. Just like the French. If we go back to that time when the world, and particularly the French, called our bluff, as we remove the Bretton Woods gold-backed international monetary regime, the world shifted toward their own gold standard as best they could. And frankly, I can't think of any more reasonable thing to do. I think you would be wise to do the same.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.